Well, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about a part of the military that's one of the most secret and secretive, and that is the U.S. Navy's submarine service. And we'll be talking with the co-author of a book that came out a couple of years ago, just fairly recently been republished in paperback. The title of the book is Blind Man's Bluff, The Untold Story of American Submarine Espionage. And our guest is Sherry Sontag. She's an award-winning investigative reporter who has written both for the National Law Journal and also the New York Times. Her co-author, by the way, on this book is Christopher Drew, who also works at the New York Times. And what the book does is it looks at a little bit of the history of submarine espionage, picking up right after World War II and continuing to the recent past. I think that perhaps if people sort of thought about what submariners were doing during the Cold War, they perhaps thought, well, what they were doing was they were cruising around and were on standby in case there was nuclear war. But what the authors reveal is that, in fact, they were also engaged in a lot of intelligence gathering. And much of this is material that simply hasn't been reported before or talked about before. So as we talk, you're certainly welcome to call if you have questions, comments. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good. Any place that you can hear us, that's 800-222-9455. So 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Well, Ms. Sontag, thanks for talking with us today.
Well, thanks for having me on.
We appreciate it. This is something that I know you and Christopher Drew actually worked on for some time, but it also was one of those subject areas, I think, that must have been difficult to report because a lot of this material was classified. And traditionally, the people who are in the submarine service are a very closed-mouthed bunch of people. They simply don't – they didn't – talk about what it is that they did. They couldn't even tell their families what it is that
they
did.
Tell their wives or kids or best friends, their parents. Imagine doing something in journalism where you uncover the most important story in the world and somebody comes up to you and says, well, we can't publish this. I mean, you can't tell anyone that you've accomplished this. And then the next day, walking across the street and coming that close to being hit by a car and having the police officer come up to you and go, well, God, I'm really sorry this happened, but, you know, I need you not to tell anybody. And then you hold on to that, and you hold on to that all day, all month, for weeks and for years. And that's what how these guys lived. I mean, they'd be gone for 6 months at a time and come home and, you know, how was work, honey? Fine. No matter what happened. They couldn't even say, the shipyard workers even, couldn't even come home if one of the guys working died that day and say what happened, because then it would beg the question, what were you working on? So they would just keep it all in.
So how is it then you managed to find a number of people who were willing to talk to you and tell you the stories of what had happened to them, these stories that before, outside of the service, they hadn't been able to tell anybody?
Well, they couldn't even tell their friends in the service. I mean, you couldn't tell anybody who wasn't on your boat what your particular boat did.
Hmm.
Well, first of all, a lot of books that you read, there are like three, four, you know, main sources, and then a lot of fill-in people. In our case, nobody opened up a vein and said, okay, here's the story. Instead, Chris and I ran around for 6 years, and we just kept asking questions. And after a while, it's like an archaeological dig. You could piece things together. I mean, I'll give you an example. We had heard that a submarine, one of the cable tap submarines, had gotten somehow attacked in the Sea of Okhotsk, and that divers had died, and that it was because the Soviets had found the cable tap. But the person who told us that had not been on the boat. So right away you know, okay, that did not happen, but something might have. So we start calling up people on the USS Seawolf, trying to figure out what did happen. We knew about 1980, 1981. The phones kept getting slammed down. Finally, one fellow was like, oh, I'm not going to talk to you at all. I'm getting off the phone now. I'm going to do target practice. And I was a little desperate. So I asked him if he was going to give up his chance to teach a 5-foot-tall New York City woman journalist how to shoot a gun. And he couldn't resist. So he invited me over, and we shot a 9mm Beretta and a Colt 45 and a 357 Magnum. And by the way, when you see people going boom, 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 like shot after shot on television, they're lying. One pull of that trigger and you've got to rest. Your finger won't work again for a few minutes. And it was over the rifles that the fellow looks at me and says, "We weren't attacked. Nobody died. We got stuck." That's all he'd say. And to me, stuck meant, oh, God, there's like a Soviet ship above and not letting you go anywhere, like, you know, keeping track of you, not letting you surface, because there had been a story we had already found like that. What we later found out after another dozen or so interviews, by now using the word stuck, so, you know, I guess people thought we knew a little bit more than we did, was that the Seawolf had literally gotten, had like sort of ski-like legs so it could sit on the bottom while divers got walked out and serviced these cable taps that were really crucial because they were military telephone cables that the Soviets had no way of knowing we could actually access. So it was literally an ear right inside the Soviets' minds. And that their storm had kicked up, and these ski-like legs had buried in the sand. The boat was literally stuck. You couldn't do a full emergency blow because if you popped to the surface, you'd get caught, and these guys already knew they had self-destruct charges on board. So if they got caught, they were dead anyway. And they came there, and then sand started coming in the water intake valves. Submarines recycle water from the seas for various systems. But now, because the boat had gotten so dug in, the water intakes, which should have been of like a foot, 3 feet above the seabed, were now flat against it, and they were pulling in sand, rocks, and sea creatures. So that was beginning to gum up all the machinery, and they really almost didn't get out. Now, the fact that the Soviets found the tap is true, but the interesting thing is they were on their way to find the tap pretty much while Seawolf was there, but not because of Seawolf, but because Ronald Pelton, the spy, had told them it was there. But the cable, and indeed, shortly after Seawolf escaped, the survey ship shows up and reaches down, picks up this cable tap, this two-ton tap pod that is programmed like a VCR because it's meant to sit at the bottom of the sea of a coast for a year. So you want the best lines at the best times to conserve tape, and opened it up, and in case they had any doubt as to who put it there, found a small part emblazoned with the words "Property of the United States." Well, cable tapping was so crucial to us that we kept going, only now not in the Sea of Okhotsk, which was relatively desolate, but in the Barents Sea. People listening may remember the Barents because they saw the water lapping endlessly as it was an attempt made to save the men of Kursk. Well, that same sea is surrounded by Soviet naval bases, and it also had an even more crucial cable. And we had the USS Parchy servicing that cable tap, even though it was remarkably dangerous.
And just
we kept it up to the end of the Cold War.
In case anybody just, I sort of want to underline this because it's one of the amazing stories of the tell. In case anybody's not quite sure what it is we're talking about here, we're talking about the fact that the United States. Literally, we're talking about undersea communications cables that were used to carry military transmissions, Soviet military transmissions. And what it is that the United States did was it mounted these missions using submarines to go down to the bottom where these cables were and literally tap them, put a device on there that would allow us to listen in to all of the Soviet military communications, and that we managed to pull this off, and it was there in place for some period of time until, as you say, someone told the Soviets that was there. If that hadn't happened, they may never have found them.
Well, and they never found the one in the Barents. I'll give you an example of how important the one in the Barents is. It's now years after, you know, several years after Pelton has compromised the Sea of Okhotsk tap, which is on the Pacific side between the Soviet Union and the Kamchatka Peninsula. Now we've got the one in the Barents going. And in fact, there's some indication we actually went back to a cost later and put another one down, just in a different spot. I want to tell you the story of one of the things that we got off the tap, but then I want to tell you the story of how we figured out how to do this in the first place. But one of the things that happened while our tap was running was that we mounted a naval exercise, a very large exercise called Able Archer, and that it was just that, a military exercise. From the Soviet point of view, however, they saw all of this hardware massing, and it was at the time of the Reagan administration, early Reagan administration, where he had been still using the phrase "evil empire," And the Soviets were terrified by that phrase because they believed that whenever you're about to start a war, the way you make it palatable to your people is you make the other side not human. So the evil empire to them sounded like a prelude to war. It was a way to dehumanize them. So if we were preparing for a first strike, we can get away with it. So when they saw this massive exercise taking place, there were a number of people within the Soviet Union that believed that we were preparing for a first strike. Now, it's interesting. We didn't know they were taking it this way. And we were probably kind of lucky that they didn't decide to do a preemptive strike under the circumstances. Because at the time, we believed that they were ready to do a first strike at any minute. They believed that we were. And what we found out from the TAP was that their response was entirely defensive, that as a people, they were no more willing to start a nuclear war than we were, that we actually had more in common than we thought. And indeed, if you notice, Reagan's rhetoric changes very quickly. Now, one reason is there's a young officer, or not so young officer, in the middle of the Able Archer panic from the Soviet side, watching all this and getting very worried that somebody was going to push a button by accident, you know what I mean, panic and start something. And that was Mikhail Gorbachev. On our side, we, about months later, get these tapes, and we hear what their response was to our exercise, and we realize that we could have panicked them into launching. And suddenly Reagan comes out with his hand open and says, Gorbachev, and they start shaking hands and being real good friends. It's like two kids who, like, you know, realize that they almost got into a lot of trouble by going after each other and go, okay, we're going to stop this right now. But it was one of the reasons that both sides were so open to the concept of, like, glasnost and perestroika. It had a lot to do with the fact that they realized they came very, very close out of sheer misunderstanding. That's probably the most dramatic thing that those taps provided. They also provided just an ear inside the other side's minds. Mm. You know, in a very close society, you don't really know what's going on. The Soviets were able to do a lot of spying by turning people. They got Johnny Walker, they got Ronald Pelton. We did it with technology. And what was probably not understood at the time, but looking back, one of the most stabilizing influences of the Cold War was how much each side was able to learn about each other. Do you want to hear how we actually figured out how to do this?
Sure. Well, I'll tell you what. Maybe what I should do, just for the benefit of anybody who might have tuned in here, is reintroduce you so folks will know who it is that they're listening to. We're talking this morning in this part of Focus 580 with Sherry Sontag. She's an investigative reporter. She has worked both for the National Law Journal and the New York Times. She's the co-author, along with Christopher Drew, of a book that looks at American submarine espionage during the Cold War. The title of their book is Blind Man's Bluff. It was bestseller when it came out. That was a couple of years ago. It's been recently republished by in paperback by Perennial. So and has some pretty interesting stories in it. So if you're interested in military history or naval history or Cold War history, you might want to take a look at it. It's out now.
Well, just a quick aside. We were talking before about how secretive this all is and how these guys didn't tell their wives or kids or parents or best friends what they were doing. The men had been coming out to our signings and buying armloads of these of Blind Man's Bluffs. So we can sign them and say things like, Scott can't tell you where he's been or what he's done, but read this, you'll understand. Mm-hmm. One fellow who's on Parchi now, and we know Parchi's not tapping cables off of Russia the way it did off the Soviet Union, but she can still tap cables, and there are other targets out there. He asked me to write a letter to his 18-month-old son explaining why Dad hasn't been there for his kid's entire life on the assumption that when the kid was 18 years old, Dad still wouldn't be able to tell him. You know, so one of the reasons this hit the list as quickly as it did was that the submariners came out in force and wanted to give one to everyone they knew so they could essentially keep their secrecy oaths but have the people in their lives sort of have a clue as to what it was all about.
Yeah. The one of the things that's really comes through very clearly is just how, and you know, certainly being in the military is dangerous, but this may be one of the most dangerous parts of the service to be in. And just in passing, you mentioned something, and I just want to go back and underscore it just so people will hear it and appreciate the fact that these the submarines we're talking about, the ones that were engaged in espionage, were equipped with self-destruct charges so that these guys were supposed to, if they got caught, they were supposed to blow themselves up.
Not all of them. I mean, this was The self-destructs were a very special case. Our government was no more interested in blowing up a boat of submariners than, you know, than Putin was in seeing the Kursk kids not get rescued. I mean, albeit the fact that Putin acted very stupidly during that accident. But so it was special cases like tapping these cables for the simple reason, number one, it could be construed as an act of war that we were, I mean, these were seas that fit as neatly into the Soviet Union as the Chesapeake Bay fits into our eastern seaboard, you know, or one of the Great Lakes fits in over where you guys are. So it wasn't every sub that went out. And remember, there are two kinds of subs. You introduced me saying we all thought that subs were waiting to help launch a nuclear attack. Mm-hmm. There were missile subs, boats that were equipped and designed basically only to shoot nuclear missiles. They were moving silos, and their job was to hide with pride. You stayed out of everyone's way. You took no chances. You were there if you were called on. But then there were the attack subs, and the attack subs during the Cold War, just about everybody who rode an attack submarine during the Cold War has had the dual role as spy. That's what they did. During World War II, submarines were basically carrier group, you know, escorts, and they shot torpedoes and things. But during the Cold War, submarines were largely spy boats. They were our premier espionage vehicle, as a matter of fact, because what could be more stealthy than something that slips through the water unseen? Mm. I wanted to tell you the story of how we came up with the idea of cable tap.
Yeah, right.
There was a fellow named Captain James Bradley who took over the job as the country's top submariner, meaning it was his job to devise the missions. And the minute he got the job, one of the things he was told about, remember I told you these guys didn't even know what the guys on the other boats were doing, was about an old submarine of ours called the USS Halibut that had been refitted. So even though she looked like an old clunker, she had been given things like cameras that could dangle all the way down to the ocean bottom. And those, I mean, that sounds easy now. You see on television these robotic things that go down. But at the time, everything had to be figured out. At one point, you know, these fish that had strobe lights and cameras and sonar and video and still and everything else would fail because the wires on them were breaking down, because we didn't realize that at those pressures, the gold coating the wires would compress at a different rate than the wire itself. So everything had to be figured out from scratch. So we had devised these things at great effort and great cost, and now we have this boat that could literally seek out things like lost Soviet MiGs or missiles, ballistic missiles sent up in test shots to try to get a look at their technology. I mean, there was a treasure trove on the ocean bottoms at the same time. Nobody bothered to guard it because it was considered legitimately inaccessible. So Bradley finds out that we have Halibut, and she's equipped with these fish, and he looks at a map and he says, you know, here are these military bases on the Kamchatka Peninsula, separated from the Soviet mainland by the Sea of Okhotsk. Here are all these bases surrounding the Barents Sea. How are these guys communicating with Moscow or even their home bases on shore? They could send everything through the air, but then it would have to be gazingle, you know, encrypted. Mm. And not only that, we still might be able to figure out what it had in it. Or they would want and demand a hardwired telephone system, something that they had every reason to believe would be inaccessible because the Sea of Okhotsk was, you know, 300-400 feet deep, the Barents 600-800 feet. I mean, we didn't have the assets. Nobody did to send divers down that deep, or so they thought. We had been playing with something called Sea Lab, so we actually did have an idea of how to do it. And Bradley thought, what an idea if we could somehow find and tap that cable. Here's the problem. He doesn't really know the cable exists. He's guessing. Simple. It made sense. One should be there. And he certainly doesn't know where it's been laid. I mean, the Sea of Okhotsk is 611,000 square miles. And this telephone cable that he's envisioning, he knows by virtue of how telephone cables are built, could be more than about 5 inches wide. How do you find a strand 5 inches wide in a sea that's 611,000 square miles? How do you get permission to even try going into a sea that the Soviets have claimed as their own during the height of the Cold War, where you risk sparking the very war you're trying to prevent? How do you get permission from the president to do that? Well, But when we first heard the quandary, we envisioned, you know, all sorts of men in uniforms and people trying to turn spies, and God knows what we envisioned. What we didn't count on, though, was Jim Bradley himself. Bradley was alone in the Pentagon. It was about 3 in the morning, and he started to drift off. You know that place between awake and sleep,
mm-hmm.
when you're real tired but you're not quite out?
Mm-hmm.
And his mind goes back to when he was growing up in the German section of Missouri, and his mom used to drag him on Mississippi riverboat rides. Every summer, every week, sometimes twice a weekend, because for her it was a way to escape the summer heat. There was a big band on board. All of her friends were there. And you could see how interesting that trip over and over and over again sounded to your average 9- or 10-year-old boy. So Bradley would end up in the pilot house talking to the captains. And after a while, they ran out of things to say to him. So he'd end up head on the rail watching the shore go by. And you know how a kid in a car on the highway will, like, read out the signs? There's McDonald's, there's Texaco, there's Exxon, Burger King, yay! You know?
Mm-hmm.
Have you driven with a kid in a car lately?
Not in a while, but I'm with you.
Okay. Well, maybe you did it when you were a kid in a
car.
Yeah,
maybe.
Anyway, we did. Bradley would read the signs on the beach, and he would read the signs that marked mileage, and he would read the signs that marked location. He would read the signs that said cable crossing, do not anchor. Cable crossing, do not anchor. They were there to keep some idiot in a pleasure boat from snagging a phone or utility cable in the shallows.
Mm.
And Bradley suddenly comes full awake in the Pentagon and realizes if we have these idiots, so do the Soviets. I mean, maybe they're not in pleasure boats. Maybe they're in fishing boats. Same deal. If you got cables, you got to keep the boats away from them. So he got permission first from Haig, then from Kissinger, and then later from Nixon to send our most secret spy submarine into the heart of a Soviet claim sea to look for signs along a lonesome Soviet beach that read, "Hey, folks, here's our cable," or some such in Russian.
Hmm.
They found them. The signs on the beach were there. The cables were right where the signs were. That's how we found those underwater telephone cables. It's not exactly what you usually expect when you think of a military operation, is it?
No, but it's a great story.
Yeah, but it shows just how human these guys were, and because they were making it up as they went along, it wasn't the most military regimented, you know, stiff and got, you know, pull up my butt guy that would do the best work. It really was these very, very creative, sometimes off the mark guys who would do wonderful things, and often their military careers were utterly blown out of the water by what they were doing because they couldn't tell a lot of their superiors, so their superiors would exact revenge. Bradley was told he would never make admiral because all of his superiors knew with their programs were losing money to his, and he wouldn't tell them why, and they were pissed. So basically, here he's accomplishing this great stuff, but he can't tell anybody about it, and he never did make admiral. In fact, he had no need to know, so they never let him hear a word of what was on the tapes. They just told him it was good.
Yeah. There are all these stories of characters that just take on challenges or just decide, you know, they want to try to do something outrageous. Like, for example, I'm thinking of the guy who decided that he would follow a Soviet submarine through its entire cruise and managed to do that more than a month, trailed the Soviet sub. The Soviets never knew that he was there. And learned an awful lot about their procedures just by following this other boat around.
Well, you're talking about, of course, Chester Whitey Mack. He was 6'5", an absolute maverick. And we had always tried to trail Soviet missile subs. Remember, the missile sub's job was to hide with pride. It was to be a movable silo. So that there would be nuclear warheads out of reach of, you know, a first strike. If we were going to attack the Soviet Union, we would aim at their land silos first and try to take them out. If we could also take out their at sea silos, they would never be able to launch a second strike. If we could keep ours hidden, we could. So we wanted very much to be able to follow these missile subs around. But remember, you're driving 200,000 tons or something of steel. You are doing it without windows. These aren't like the tourist submarines. You are listening to sonar. And guys, if you've seen the movie Hunt for Red October, it's great fun to see, you know, Jonesy on the headsets going, "Oh yeah, there's Captain Ramus at 50 yards," or the movie U-571 where somebody guesses they've dropped a quarter, a dime, and two nickels or something on the floor. But it doesn't work that way. What you hear on your sonar headsets is static, And if there's another sub nearby, you may hear as the screw through the. So it's static against static. It's like looking for a white mouse against a white background in a snowstorm. It's enormously difficult. And in these early days, depth was almost impossible to gauge. And the Soviet subs were getting quiet enough that, you know, one way you knew the way you could tell the guy had turned, like I figured it was right or left, is it went quiet. The other side, there was a slight tonal, almost like a, you know, blowing over a bottle, because there was a slight, you know, problem with the machinery. But you're trying to follow a guy, and it's very easy to lose him. I mean, he could be right above you, and you may not know where he is. Mac, where nobody had managed to do this for more than a day or a few hours, Mac managed to follow the Yankee through 47 days and nights. We call it a near-biblical feat. And in fact, at a certain point, you know, the on shore, they're getting like practically daily reports of progress, because when Mac knew they got the Yankee had gone deep, the Yankee submarine, we called it a Yankee because it very closely resembled our best submarines, almost like a Mattel model. Mac would quickly, you know, come to the surface and flash off a quick message and then go back down and continue chase. And the other side never knew they were being chased. Now, what he did was he did this by following a lot closer than anybody had ever dared. And indeed, submarines had tried to do this after Mac, not all of them, but there were a couple of really severe collisions because you are following blind. It was in something called the Ballad of Whitey Mac that we first heard the phrase blind man's bluff in this game of blind man's bluff. Because that's what these guys realized that they were doing. It was like a game of blind man's bluff. Now, as we got better at this, we got to the point where we could pretty well trail most of the missile subs that were out there. So if there had been a Third World War, it took Whitey Mac, who was this maverick who was willing to break all the rules, follow too close. The admirals couldn't stand him. But at the same time, they knew that he was the guy to do this mission. You know, the same thing that made them really nervous, the fact that he was a little bit out of control, also made him the only guy who might be able to pull this off. And he never made admiral, in part, even though he won a Presidential Unit Citation, which is literally the highest award a submarine captain could win during peacetime. The boat, Whitey Mac won the other awards. In fact, when they wanted to give him the award in secret and without the families there, Whitey basically told them they could sort of shove their awards unless the families were at the ceremony. So they had a whole ceremony where they never once mentioned what the sub had actually done and what Whitey had actually done. But as we got better at this, we were able to sort of follow these subs around. And the danger, the damage that Johnny Walker did was very simple. He told the Soviets how often we were following them, how easily we were following them. And they did two things. First, they began to work on getting their subs more quiet. That's where the whole Toshiba scandal comes from later, because it was just one way to make it even quieter. But also, they pulled their subs out of the open oceans and back into the Barents and then onto the Arctic ice. And I'm not talking about the polar ice cap where the waters are pretty still and quiet underneath. I'm talking about all those seas around the polar ice where there are salt layers and cold layers that befuddle sonar and the cries of ringneck seals and ice crunching on ice. And it's like unless you follow a guy directly into that mess, you're never going to find him. And the closest place, the easiest way to launch a missile, the closest point between the U.S. and the Soviet Union really is over the polar ice cap. So by doing that, the Soviets essentially trumped us. They said, you're following us? Well, you know, so there, now we're going to put our subs in a place where you can't follow. And, in fact, by the end of the Cold War, those tactics and also their quieting techniques had gotten so good they had leveled the playing field. So Johnny Walker Red, had there been a Third World War in this period, could have been responsible for a second nuclear strike being possible. As it turns out, just about the time they totally leveled the playing field, they also went bankrupt, the Soviet Union did, which was really the saving grace.
We're here coming into the point where we have maybe about 12, 13 minutes left. Again, our guest is investigative reporter Sherry Sontag. She's co-author of the book Blind Man's Bluff, which is all about American submarine espionage during the Cold War. It's available now in a paperback edition published by Perennial. If you want to look at it, we have some callers here. 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. First up here is Belgium, line number one. Hello.
Yes, I've been following your discussion here, and you said initially that your subject matter was very reticent in trying to tell you anything about your stories.
Well, all through, actually.
Yes. Well, I find that very interesting because I heard about your book about 2 years ago and I've read some of it. I can't say I've read all of it, but it was given to me by a submariner.
Well, the submariners, now that it's out, are very happy that it's out. Officially, the service will neither confirm or deny and will not comment on the book. Unofficially, we've won awards from the Navy, Navy League, and and John Layman, former Secretary of the Navy, called the book brilliant in the Wall Street Journal. So they're very pleased that it's out. They didn't want to be the one. Each individual will tell you he wouldn't want to be the ones that told us anything. But now that it's out, they get to show their families a little bit of what they're about. And they do give out them out by the armloads. They really do.
Yes.
Look at me. This is not even give me credit. This is what I couldn't tell you all this time because you're just holding it in. It's a whole part of your existence, maybe in some cases the best part of their existence. And it's just a relief to tell.
Thank you.
All right. Then let's go to line two in Robinson. Hello.
Yes, David. I'd like to ask Ms. Sontag why she chose to name the book Blind Man's Bluff. With an L in it.
As opposed to Buff. We looked it up in the OED originally, and he's right. The actual phrase is Blind Man's Buff. But the popular phrase, and the one the submariners use, is Bluff, and we chose to go with what the guys were actually saying. And we debated back and forth whether or not to put a note in the book sort of saying, hey, we're not idiots, we know what the OED says, but we decided not to. But you're right. The original game, that blindfolded game, was Blind Man's Buff.
Uh-huh. Even though it's a corruption of the proper name.
Yes, because the people we were writing about used the corruption as the phrase.
Okay.
One they never would have recognized.
All right. Let's go to another caller here. Line three, this is Champagne. Hello.
Hi. I'd like to thank Ms. Sontag for the book. As a submariner, an ex-submariner, I should say, I'd like to say you did a wonderful job of telling what the guys did and not able to talk about.
Thank you very much. Was I right when I tell people that it's sort of nice for you to be able to sort of see, give the folks in your life an idea of who you are?
Absolutely, and I particularly like the soft cover because it shows what boats did, not what they did, but when they did it, and that they did something.
Yeah, well, it's very funny. What he's referring to is we added in our soft cover an appendix, an awards index. If, interestingly enough, the Navy did not have one of those where you could look at a sub and just see what awards it won over the years. We had to go through just tons and tons of printouts where every boat for every year of every kind, not just every submarine, every ship, every boat, every, like, you know, rowboat practically, if they did anything that got a merit citation, was listed. And we pulled out the submarines for two reasons. The first, it gives you sort of an interesting sort of little history of just how many of these subs were involved. But also we realized that in order to tell the story in a crisp way, we couldn't really credit every submarine out there that did remarkable things. And we wanted the guys to be able to look up their submarines and sort of say, here we are. Did you find your boats in there?
Some of them, yes, and some of them, no. I started off on diesel boats.
Did we miss some awards?
You didn't tell the story that the diesels did back in the late 50s.
We did. We tell all about the Gudgeon.
Well, the Gudgeon, but there were some others that did some things that...
Yeah, part of the problem is we told the story of the Kachina, which was the first spy sub that went out, and unfortunately it sank, but luckily we were able to save most of the men. The sub, the Tusk, that did the saving actually lost six of its crew members in the rescue effort. And then we tell the story about the Gudgeon, and we use a Gudgeon chapter to summarize diesel boats and then move on to the nukes, just because we were afraid of not telling the story fast enough. It was always this bridge between great stories, because we had access to so many of them, and trying to keep the book moving. And from what I hear from some of the submariners, they would have preferred we had gone into more detail on more boats.
I got to agree with you there. It was a super book, and I know you were constrained for space and for interest and cost and whatnot, but it amazes me that somehow somebody allowed you to tell that story and allowed you to get the information. Obviously, there was some informal, you can talk to them words out, because if you look at it, the submarines are very, very expensive toy if it's not used.
Well, and also the submarine force was being sunk by its own silence after the Cold War because nobody knew what they had done. There was very little incentive to keep funding them. And but it was less that when the Navy would put out periodically, everybody remember your secret seals, but they never threatened jail. So you're right. The message was a little bit mixed. And what we were doing is very specifically not going after ongoing missions. In fact, if I called a guy below a very high rank who was on a boat like an 81, and it turned out when I was calling him 8 years later, he was still active, I would beg off. And that was to protect his life, because his career, because you don't want somebody to lose their commission because they talked to you. But it was also to underscore the fact that we weren't trying to undo the missions that were going on now. But it was time, since the Cold War was over, at a certain point you have to evaluate what was done and decide if you thought it was worthwhile or not. And the Navy was just being much, much slower than anyone else, including the CIA, to declassify these things. What we did to make sure we weren't doing any harm is we actually went to several of the very high-ranking people who had tried hardest to fight us, to stop us, and we showed them the book, and we said, if you think something has to come out of here for national security reasons, speak now or forever hold your peace. And what they ended up doing is giving us just a few more details. Oh, you know, and if you do it like this, you've done a good job. So the book came out. We weren't asking for permission, because journalists don't do that, but we thought it was responsible to ask for their advice.
We have, I don't want to thank the last caller, we have somebody else here who's on a car phone, line number one. Hello?
Hello.
Yes.
I love that book. I read it 2 years ago. And what I like about it comes through in your interview today is the fact that it's a beautiful story, and it's filled with smaller stories that are fascinating.
Yeah, it's all about, I mean, the missions are told through the guys. We don't give you a dry history because these guys were just so remarkable and such wonderful people. I mean, Chris and I mean, we have no military background at all, and we're both liberal Democrats, and we realized that what these men were doing was incredibly important.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think the Navy, the submariners like that. They like the fact that we're not typical military people who could see the value in what they did.
If you were doing a story on the recent loss of the Soviet submarine and the Putin handling of it, what would be the storyline, and how would you attack that?
Well, I have done that story a couple of times, including for the Wall Street Journal, and what I've said is this, that our ability to rescue submariners at sea is very poor. We have deep submergence rescue vehicles, but what we can do with those is if we know someone's going in a test dive, we make sure he takes that dive in water shallow enough to be recoverable, and we have the DSRV on call. If our guys had gone down to the Barents and we had sent out a call for help from, you know, instantly, we couldn't have gotten there on time. First, there was no way that, I mean, it looks now that there are a few men that lived, maybe 25 men or so, that lived for some hours, but there was no way we could have gotten there and gotten down to them faster than in 3 days. And submarines just don't go down gently. The submarine force has always looked at rescue capacities as something to sort of calm the public. But most times a submarine goes down, it goes down below crush depth, where it goes so deep that it literally implodes because the water pressure gets so bad. And then even if you go down, as Kors did, in recoverable waters, unless you have the assets right on hand, you're not going to get there fast enough. Now, having said that, that doesn't excuse Putin. What Putin did will forever make him guilty of two things that I think are horrible. The first is the families of those men will always wonder if their boys could have been saved, or some of them. And for letting the, and if they had seen an instant and international race to the scene, at least it would have given them the peace that everything that could have been done was. For taking that peace away from them, Putin is guilty and he's wrong. Mm. Also, you know, friendships are not made when two countries are at each other's throats. They're made at moments when when groups come together and help each other. And you don't know what's going to happen later between the U.S. and Russia. And the fact is, the lost opportunity of being able to have that bonding experience, he got so defensive, oh, we're not going to be saved by, you know, a big brother across the ocean, that he forgot that he really could have taken great strides toward the two people's bonding if he had allowed that to happen. So he threw that away, too. The Soviet Union used to have assets that could have saved its men, including deep-sea divers, deep-sat divers, but they had taken apart the boats that supported those divers because these guys have to breathe special gas mixtures and everything else. That's why they were stuck calling to ultimately Norway and Britain, and then by then it was too late. So he should have acted faster. The end for the men would not have been different, I believe. The end for the families and maybe internationally would have been.
I want to ask you real quick here, and unfortunately we're coming to the point where we have a minute or two left, but the Russian military continues to say that they believe the Kursk hit another submarine, and that's what happened. A foreign submarine that was monitoring the Russian naval exercises in the Barents Sea. What do you think happened?
I believe that it's either that is borderline either enormous denial or borderline bull. First off, there were two explosions in Kursk, one measuring 3.5 on the Richter scale. Where is this phantom boat or foreign boat or submarine that had that kind of massive collision? And number two, we were at a point in time when we have collisions, we both say, oops, we've had a collision. The fact that we'd be somehow that close to the military exercise, and there were like 23 Russian boats around as part of this military exercise. So imagine a severely damaged foreign sub, U.S. or British or something, trying to escape after these massive explosions, clunking all the way. And there is no sub that's come up with that kind of damage. I think it's very hard for people to believe that their own cursed technology killed their guys, but I really believe that it was probably a sub-rock torpedo, which means a torpedo that was powered by rocket fuel. So what you have is the fuel goes up and then the warhead goes up. Hmm. There has been no evidence other than the Russians crying foul that anybody else was involved. And believe me, we've tracked down some pretty good collisions where we were involved. It does happen. I just don't believe it happened in this case.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to stop because we've used our time. But certainly for people who want to read more on the subject, you can look for the book Blind Man's Bluff. It is now published in paper by Perennial by Sherry Sontag and Christopher Drew with Annette Drew. Ms. Sontag, thanks very much for talking with us.
If you want to give them my email address, if they want to ask some more questions, it's Sherry, Sherry, at Panix, PANIX.com.
All right. Well, thanks very much again for being our guest today.
Thanks
we appreciate
for
it.
Me.